Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rooted Recovery Stories. We are closing out Mental Health Awareness Month and opening up June, which is Pride Month. And I cannot think of a better guest than the tremendously wonderful individual I have here today with me, Inclusion Tennessee's Executive Director, Phil Cabucci. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. So I will say to our viewers and listeners that as all of our episodes are pre-recorded, today is marks a week from the mass shooting here in Nashville at one of our schools. For those of you who don't know, we record in Nashville and we're both here on Music Row downtown. And I will say that, you know, it's weird. I was gone all week last week in Florida, and to see how quickly other parts of the country moved on and then to come home, because my heart stayed in the trauma of it all the whole time I was gone.
Yeah.
This is our first of something like this in our community here in Nashville.
Yep. It was, my heart sank as soon as the news kind of came across my phone as an active aggressor was coming through a school in Green Hills, and the news started trickling out very quickly. And then to hear that it was an elementary school and that it was a private school and that it was a Christian school, and then that there was children involved, and then the headmistress of a school, and then women and leaders who have been involved in community for so long, and then babies of 9 years old. Every piece of the story is just heartbreaking, and then to see how quickly our community came together. And we're a community in mourning, over something that is just so heart-wrenching, is remarkable. And then to also see how quickly our community has come together to demand action from our legislature, is inspiring. At the same time, I mean, just before we started filming, I was showing video of just how quickly our youth are getting engaged to demand change. And I think that that's an inspiring moment. And it's something that, I'm inspired by. Mm-hmm. It's something that I'm hopeful that, at this date and time, I hope that we continue to see. Mm-hmm. And I know that my hope is that the loss that our community, our city, our families, these loved ones have experienced is not something that is in vain.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly put. We're at the crossroads of so many things, and we're here to talk about mental health today, and our nation, but specifically our city, was just largely traumatized.
Absolutely.
A lot of people don't understand the definitions of trauma, or think that it's something that happens specifically to them, but you hit the nail on the head when you said we are a city in mourning. And I hope that, when I was reflecting about, how we wanted to talk about this and what my heart shared, my heart right now is coming from a place of, I hope that by the time this airs, our hearts are still in the same place of fresh hurt for those people. Tenderness, intention to take action, see change. There have been more mass shootings in our country than days of the year so far. And people who are mentally well don't commit mass shootings.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
You have got one heck of a story of resilience and healing from a history of, you know, as many of us do, battling as life throws at us, mental health struggles.
Yeah.
And gosh, it is a great story of, I think, victory and then ending up at a place where, you know, you and I check in often, and I love it because, yeah, you know, it's an ongoing, should I say fight or an ongoing battle slash choice that we have every day to wake up and check in on each other and our friends and, you know, see where we're at. And so I want to start from the beginning because it's the best place to start. You sure. Were born where?
I was born in northern New Jersey, New York City area. I am turning 40 this month when it airs, obviously.
Congratulations. Happy birthday.
I've made it.
Yeah.
So, it's been a wild ride. It's been a wild ride.
Indeed.
I was born and raised in the New York City, New Jersey area, and was born to a very conservative family, and a family that when I say conservative family, you don't really put the idea of conservative family and then New York City in the same sentence. Usually you don't really think those two things can coexist,
especially as a southerner.
Right.
Definitely wouldn't. My thought would be the exact opposite,
right? And my family was enmeshed in the church, in a evangelical conservative evangelical church. They were very active in the church. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I grew up. That's the world that I grew up in. And to this day, they are still very active in the church. Mm-hmm. And that's their life. That is their, what makes their bodies tick. Mm-hmm. That's what gives them joy and happiness. And where they find their connection.
Sure. So. I'll ask you, because I think it's important to ask from every angle, you know, growing up, do you remember finding fulfillment and joy through those avenues to a certain extent till a certain point?
Hmm. I think because of the world that you grew up in, you kind of have to, right? Hmm. You have to find joy. You have to find connection in what expectations your family has for you. And so, yes, for a certain part of my life, for the early parts of my growing up years, my, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, early, you know, preteen years, absolutely. I found connection. I found, supposed joy. But at the same time, I was also definitely experiencing disconnection, right? I there was a lot of confusion that I was experiencing in my own life that I didn't necessarily understand. And as a young person, I wasn't necessarily finding my place.
Mm.
And some of that still to this day, almost 30 years later, I'm still figuring out. And yeah. So it's this this ongoing journey of saying, oh, okay, this is not the world that I, there was something in this world that wasn't right for me then.
Yeah.
So,
you know, so here's a great place to I guess interject. We'll drop the bomb and say, you identify as?
I identify as a gay man. I came out multiple times in my teenage years.
Yeah.
Definitely had some really difficult experiences with that as a teenager. And I think that was certainly something that made things really difficult. As a teenager, especially coming out of a conservative home, coming out of a home that was enmeshed in evangelical culture and Christian life, that it made for a really hard world to navigate. Mm. So
you know, taking a step back just one second, when we talked about how as a youngster, you were. Church was life. Mm-hmm. So much of this is, you know, if anybody is watching has seen any of my stories shared, you know that there are a lot of similarities between, you know, mine and Phil's. So, you know, you're going through that state of confusion because you're starting to have feelings, mm-hmm. thoughts, things that are contradictory to yep. how we were raised.
Correct.
What did you do with that?
Oh, that's an interesting question, Patrick. I think, you know, for me, at first I wasn't accepted, right? The response from my parents was, this is not who you are. This is how you are supposed to be. This is how you're supposed to be different. You are not supposed to be this way. This is something that can be fixed. This is something that God does not want for you. And I was told that I could be someone that could be changed.
So how old were you when you opened up about having these feelings?
Oh, I started at 13 years old.
Wow. That's brave.
Yeah.
Many of us, myself included, I didn't even acknowledge to myself at that age. So,
well, at 13 years old, I knew that I was different.
Yeah.
I knew that I had different, I knew that I had feelings that were different than what I think would have been typically expected of me mm-hmm. in the environment that I was being raised in. Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's the easiest way to put it.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that I didn't feel like I had that support to be like, okay, you're different. So we can raise you this way. Right.
No, there was an antithesis.
Correct.
And that's what I was getting at for me, kind of in a different, and I know we're talking about your story here, but again, there's some parallels.
So many. Yeah.
So, you know, I couldn't acknowledge to myself because acknowledging to myself meant spiritual defeat, right? Like I was raised to the point where it's like, you know, homosexuality was a sin and a direct correlation to the level of the health of my relationship to God.
Right.
And so here you are coming out and saying this to your parents, you know, hey, I'm struggling. Mm-hmm. The belief was on your end that, did you believe that you needed to fix it?
So you said something that I'll correct. I never said that I was struggling.
Really?
I said that I was gay. And the words that were put into my mouth or the words that I was told was that I was struggling.
Wow.
I knew that I was different and I knew what I was from the very young age. I knew what I was attracted to. I knew who I was And I had a very keen sense as to who I was meant to be. Mm. And that was something that I never had the freedom in my familial space mm-hmm. to fully live into. Mm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I had multiple attempts at coming out, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. And every single time that I did, sometimes it was coming out because my mother found something.
Right.
You know, it could have been a printout of something online,
right.
Or it could have been a magazine that I had purchased, or a piece of an article that I ripped out of a newspaper that spoke on LGBT issues or gay issues, or a chat that I had had with somebody on AOL, because that was the thing then, right? And there was so many different things that I had tried to hide because I knew that I wasn't being accepted mm-hmm. in my home, that I had to constantly hide who I was. And it was a constant struggle to navigate that world of almost living two different lives, of having to be one person for my family mm-hmm. and then one person for who I was meant to be in this world. And that was a constant struggle. And it was something that I had to continuously and every single day wake up and battle.
Yeah.
And as much as I tried to be someone else, right, or fit into the mold that my parents wanted me to be, I never was able to get to that space.
If we could have everybody that's tuning in right now to raise their hand that identifies with that exact same scenario. Yeah. Oh my gosh, the hands that we would see.
Yeah.
I mean, and I know my hand flies up at that. Gosh. Yeah. So when I ask you, you know, what was the period where you remember a shift having to take place, pressure being applied? You come out multiple times at a certain point. Mm-hmm. Hey, buddy, something's got to change. If you're hanging out with the people that are saying this isn't okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, it's interesting. When I was 18 years old, you know, at 18, most people say that, you know, at 18, you're an adult, you mm-hmm. have the freedom to choose mm-hmm. what you want to do with your life. And I want to preface all of this by saying that even to this day at almost 40 years old, depending on when you watch this, or listen to this, that I actually still do not hold or harbor any grudge towards my parents.
That's a testament to the beautiful work you've done on yourself and your mental health and emotional health since then.
And it's taken a long time to get there, but I don't hold a grudge to them or any bitterness towards them, because that's what they knew, what they were raising me in deeply in what they believe. Mm-hmm. And we have come to different viewpoints on life, and that's where it stands.
Yeah.
But I think what I'll say is that, you know, going back to when I was 18, I was really given one option at 18 years old. I had gotten myself into some trouble. I was a kid, you know, in senior year in high school. I was desperate for attention because I didn't feel connected to my classmates. I was trying to earn or buy friends the best I could. I felt rejected. I was bullied. I wanted to be loved. I didn't feel like I had support at home. And so I was just, I was grasping for anything that I could get. Right. And so, when I had gotten myself into some trouble, and my only option at that point was to, my parents said, okay, well, you need to go to, get your life right with God.
Which meant
going to a Bible college, mm-hmm. which was fine if that was all it was. Mm-hmm. But what my parents didn't tell me was that they were putting me in a conversion therapy program as well. And so I was sent to a dorm where all of the other gay kids were put as well. So in addition to being part of a Bible program, which was aptly titled or loosely titled Bible Boot Camp. Mm-hmm. I was also part of a dorm where every single gay kid was placed as mm-hmm. well. So we had the worst of the worst work assignments, and we had additional therapies that we had to be put through to try to straighten our lives out.
Right. Pun intended.
Pun intended. Correct. And you know, be it what it was, at the end of the day, it clearly didn't work. But it was also I wouldn't say it was to the extreme of anything with, like, you know, some of the horror stories that we've heard about, mm-hmm. Conversion therapies where they, you know, beat people or anything of right. that nature, but it was still very much an extensive brainwashing of utilizing the Bible to try to brainwash someone into submission in terms of trying to change their life
right.
for the better, or for what they perceive to be the better, I would yeah. say. Right. That didn't work. In my case, and after about 9 months of the program, I basically said to my family, if you want to see me again, I'm coming home. And so it was really this option of, like, you have basically this place was trying to make me become a camp counselor for the summer to work with children. And I was absolutely not going to do that. And so I said to my family, I'm coming home or you will never see me again. And I came home and I got a job at Starbucks.
Which was your
lifesaver. It was the first time in my life that I ever walked into a job, into a space, into a building where I could be my true authentic self as a queer person. And I have often said, and I've said this many times, that Starbucks, this is not an advertisement for them by any means, even though I'm holding their cup of coffee.
We love Starbucks.
Yeah.
It's okay.
It's Starbucks in 2002 was the company that saved my life. Mm. It was their processes of how they treated employees, how employees could walk in that door and be who they wanted to be, mm-hmm. Was the, it was exactly what I needed to feel and know that there was a place for me and that I belonged mm-hmm. to something mm-hmm. greater than myself. And so that was actually the first time in my life that I had ever been somewhere that I felt like I could truly be someone, something, part of something. Mm-hmm. It was the first time that I felt like I could actually celebrate my identity in 18 years of existence.
It's so beautiful that I went, you know, this isn't the first time that you've shared that with me, but every time I get, you know, some tingles because in my, down my back, because I think about like that, to me, that represents the first time you found hope, ease, yeah. peace, comfort, you know, and even though nobody should have to live 18 years of their life before they find that,
yeah.
you found it.
I did.
You found it. And, you know, that moment of hope, whatever it is that, you know, those of us going through struggles of the human experience, when we find it, there are so many different shades of beautiful color that fill in those lines. And I think that that just, it's just, that is a true milestone moment in your life that, you know, sounds so simple on the outside, but those of us who know, I mean, because I can identify my first safety place, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So you moved on, you know, and I want to go, you know, through the next phases of your trajectory. You know, there's, you still had some tumultuous relationship with your parents. It wasn't ironed out.
Yeah.
Your family. Yeah. What kind of happened in, you know, going forward in your career and in your relationships, and how did you navigate through the lens of following the path of your true self?
Well, so after my first year of, or my first few months of working for Starbucks, I had to continue on with college or university. And so I was given one option again to go to school. And my only option was Jerry Falwell's Liberty University.
No.
Yes. And so certainly at that point, I didn't really have an option mm-hmm. to go anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And it was a school that, you know, at that point, still a very conservative institution, still is to this day.
Yep.
A school that doesn't support LGBTQIA plus students in any way. Mm-hmm. And is a place that really doesn't actively support a diverse thought in any ways either. Mm-hmm. Right. And so when I went there, and I was a major in communication, and actually audio broadcast, which is why you have this beautiful velvety voice. Not really.
Nice.
I went to school there. My parents had this broad hope for me to, you know, find a career and be a champion for Christ, mm-hmm. you know, and all well and good.
Sure.
You know,
I say all the time in regards to my parents, because, you know, I've gotten to a place kind of similar to you yeah. where we absolutely have different beliefs on mm-hmm. issues and what have you. But through the healing, I've come to a place of, and I don't know if you would say the same way, but like, I fully believe in my heart that my parents were doing the best they could with what they had and what they knew,
right,
based on the belief system that they had inherited yeah. or picked up along the way.
Yeah.
And no matter how harmful that was to us, you know, that's where we get to kind of identify and say, well, that hurt me.
Yep.
And I get to say that.
Yep.
You know, I have to do with it what I will. And, you know, it's their responsibility to, you know, deal with and own their part. So, yeah.
I don't hold anything against my parents for anything. Do I think that they made poor decisions in raising me? Absolutely. And are there things that I hope that they've learned? Yes. And are there things that I hope that my brother has learned as he is now a father? Yes. And are there things that I have learned that I hope I can instill, even though I'm not going to be a parent, that I can help instill in other parents in my work? Absolutely. Right. And I think that even those who like listen to these podcasts and listen to work that I'm engaged in will learn that these are, there are activities that we engage in, that parents engage in, that sometimes will have very long-term negative effects on their child. And they have to be thinking about the long term and what that will do. Now, this is not a parenting podcast, right? So, you know, but I think that there's still a really critical conversation that can be had around when we think about long term mental health effects of decisions that parents make on behalf of their children, especially when they're in that really critical age of 18 to 26.
Absolutely. Right. Well, and I kind of want to go a little further with what you said. You know, this isn't a parenting podcast, and neither you or I are parents, but
indeed,
I'm a firm believer, and I heard this once said, that whether you choose to have children or not, we are tasked with the responsibility of transferring messages, being a role model, whether we want to or not, to people who are younger than us throughout our life that are exposed to our image, our actions, our everything. Yep. So whether or not you adopt children, you have biological children, or neither of those things, there are people that are watching and learning from you and me, and no matter who you are.
Right.
So does this apply to everyone? Yes, what I'm about to say. Generational curses, bondage, trauma will go on. It's not our fault what we inherit.
Yeah.
But it is 100% our responsibility for identifying, accepting it, working on it, and deciding, because one of two things is going to happen. We're going to fix the ways that those things showed up in our parents' lives and not let them show up in ours and how we behave. Or we're going to turn into and do the same things they did. And it might look different, right? But the root of it is the same. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's so important that we talk about family systems and trauma of our upbringing.
Yeah.
You know, and I love what one of my friends who I'm interviewing for coming up here soon as well, she talks about all the time that, you know, one day she's got kids. She goes, one day my kids are going to be in therapy because of me. I want them to be in therapy because of me, because I'm a human.
Yeah.
And I'm just hoping that I can take ownership and work on those things and give them less to be less to work on.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so, oh, I just, you know, I could go on and on forever about all of that, but I think that, you know, we're all here coming from some, we didn't just exist all of a sudden, you know.
Yeah.
We had primary caregivers, and so
you know you bring up a really good point, and we'll continue our conversation.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that really changed my perception of really my entire life and my entire lived experience were a couple very simple words, and it was the tail end of Oprah and Bruce Perry's book, What Happened to You? And it was literally part of the title is what happened to you happened for you. And even to what you're talking about now with this parent and my parent, this parent will be in, my kids will be in therapy. I had to take that when I when I read those words, when I heard Oprah say those words in that audiobook, which Oprah's a, you know, a goddess to me, mm-hmm. great, you know, anyway, when I heard those words said, what happened to you happened for you, it was like a cacophony of birds. I don't know. I'm not probably not even using the right language here, sure. but doves just flew out of my chest.
Yeah.
I felt freedom for so many ways. It was just this beautiful moment mm-hmm. of freedom that I felt, where I realized for the first time that I've gone through all of these things. I've experienced all of this pain. I've experienced all of this heartbreak. I've experienced all of this struggle only for one very simple thing, that I've gone through all of this. Now I can help other people.
Absolutely. So as you talk about that, I think about how knowing your story and what you're doing today, which we'll end with the flushing that out.
Yeah.
But I will say that I have to interject here and say that I think, believe in my heart of hearts, that what you're doing today is so the meaning and the change that it's affecting in the lives of others is going to go on and, you know, be multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. And, you know, talking about what happened to you happened for you, you went from experiencing, you know, some little t, some big t trauma, dealing with your sexuality and what have you, which is a lot, you know, birth to 20s. Mm-hmm. And then going professionally, you know, you got to a place where, if I might put words in your mouth, you were very, you had hit a really high professionally.
Yeah.
And it took you to a place where, and I want you to flush this out in your own words,
sure.
but a place where you almost took your own life.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Yeah. So I, after I left, after I finished school, or before I finished school, I had scored an internship with Warner Brothers Records. So I'll kind of speed up my 15 years and then we'll get here.
Yeah.
After I finished school, I secured an internship with Warner Brothers Records, and moved back to New York and had a short-lived but a successful career with Warner Brothers Records, and got laid off about 5 years into that career. Thanks to a lovely thing called Napster and LimeWire.
No.
You remember those?
No.
Things. Basically killed the music industry for a while.
I think it killed one or two of my family computers too. Yeah,
probably so. Killed mine too. Was downloading stuff and I didn't realize it was killing my own job.
Yeah.
Long story short, when I got laid off, I realized at that point that I couldn't live in New York on unemployment, mm-hmm. But I wanted to continue a career in the music industry because that was something that was giving me life, and it was a sense of freedom for me and joy and creativity. And so I said, okay, well, I can't live in LA on unemployment, so I'll give Nashville a try. And so I said, okay, well, Nashville's inexpensive at the time it was.
Right.
And so I moved to Nashville, packed up my car, and left, and said, okay, I'm going to give Nashville a whirl. I landed at a friend's house and, she opened up a guest bedroom for me and said, you could land here for as long as you need. And I think I was there, and she actually offered me a job with the company she was working with, and she was a lifesaver. Truthfully, at that point, I was doing some work for her, her music website, that she was running along with her boss. And they said, hey, we need some help with this thing called Facebook. And that's what sort of turned into a long standing career for me.
Wow.
And so Facebook was just starting to become a public thing. It was originally just a social network that was used for colleges yep. at the time. And I was actively using it already in my music industry days. And so I had a lot of experience with it. And I started building out a platform for it, for these, for websites. And then it turned, for this music website. And then it turned into building out a platform for a TV station, and then building out a platform for a cafe on Music Row. And it's quickly turned into multiple clients. And then it turned into, oh, wow, Phil, you have a little bit of an agency mm-hmm. situation going on here. And then the agency turned in the business, the small business that I had turned into an agency, I should say. And by the time 5 years had rolled around of small contracts and operations, it turned from a, you know, 1, 2, 3 person operation to 20 full-time and part-time employees. And by the time 10 years rolled around, we had 100 clients and a large operation here in Nashville, and was working internationally, was working with major Fortune 100 companies. Mm-hmm. We were doing a lot of really incredible work, but really focused on social and in the social media space. And you know, in 2020, I'll take a step back and just say in sort of 2019 was at our 10-year mark for mm-hmm. for the operation, and I was starting to feel like I was kind of losing my way. And I was sort of disconnected from the work a little bit.
You're losing the passion that
I'm losing the passion. I'm like, running a business is hard.
Yeah.
It's not really what I wanted to do with my life. I had never really wanted to run a business myself. I came from a family of entrepreneurs. It's not what I wanted to be. And it's a lot of work. I have every bit of respect for anyone who is an entrepreneur. It is a lot of work. And it's just not what I wanted my life to be. Mm-hmm. And so I was also feeling at the same time that there was really a lack of opportunity. There was really a lack of opportunity for me to be engaged in my community, right? And so I was toying with the idea of maybe running for office. I was toying with the idea of, like, do I get involved in some nonprofit, more bigger nonprofit activities outside of what I was engaged in? And at the same time, I'm also, you know, dabbling in some boards and different service engagements. And I in 2019, I was still serving on the National Pride Board at that time, and I had been in service to that organization for 5 years at that point. And I said, you know, one of the things that Nashville Pride does really well is bring people together 2 days out of the year for a really great party in the park. Mm-hmm. But we have a really poor way of staying connected to our LGBTQIA plus community year round. Mm-hmm. And so there's a real gap of, like, connection. Like, what are we doing the other 364 days of the year where we are not having a big party,
right,
when it's not Pride Month?
Well, and so I have to interject here, because I think for some people who've never spent very much time here,
yeah,
that might come from other cities that right. are more connected
sure.
and what have you. So say yeah. for instance, someone from Chicago might yeah. have a hard time understanding, because there are events going on, or you see pride flags hanging year round.
Yep.
You know, and all kinds of things. And that has not been the case for Nashville. Mm-hmm. So what you're speaking to is, you know, I remember, every single Pride, I cry.
Yeah.
I cry at the parade. I cry during Pride because the people come together. The sentiment is so strong, and it's something that, you know, I don't feel year round here. Mm-hmm. And it's so very important. And right. The only other places that we get that is at the bars, which, you know what, even as a sober person, I have to say, you know, cause I go now to them right. and enjoy drag shows. I, you know, mm-hmm. connect with people. I'm able to go there safely, you know, yeah. and not fear relapse, that kind of thing. I'm so grateful for the gay bars, mm-hmm. You know, and those spaces that provide an element of safety that other spaces don't. Those are what we had in Nashville.
Right.
And so yeah. What'd you do about it?
Well, I mean, we did in 2019, I took my communications and marketing chops and I said, okay, let's do something. Let's do some research. Mm-hmm. I brought this idea to the Pride Board and they helped commission a study that basically said we're going to get a deeper understanding of what our community needs in order to thrive. Mm-hmm. And so in 2019 we did this Middle Tennessee Community Visioning Project, mm-hmm. Which really was a very simple attempt at trying to get 500 people to share their ideas around what our community needed. To our surprise, the initial survey, these events were so well attended that people had something they wanted to say, they had something they wanted to share. We had a goal of originally talking to 500 people. We ended up talking to 2,500, in wow. the course of 4 months. And we took all the findings, collected all the research, and then we shared everything in a feedback or a reporting session in December of 2019. Timeline, 2019, December of 2019. So sitting at the top of the world thinking, okay, we are going to take all of this research and we are going to deliver for our community and we are going to do some amazing things. Mm-hmm. January 2020, it is a great time to start these brand new initiatives.
Heck yeah.
Except for the fact that it was 2020.
Yeah.
And we had COVID, a pandemic worldwide. Yep. And so my 2020 started off even worse than that. And this is where we get into the conversation. Yeah. This is the hard stuff.
So I just want to recap. You've got a successful entertainment agency, management agency, and
marketing agency.
Yep. And you started to feel kind of wayward, like I need to find some fulfillment here, you know, because mm-hmm. this isn't doing it. You've set your foot about this other project. Yeah. Some big things going on.
Yep.
You had to have felt somewhat on top of the world.
I felt like
making some headway in your yeah. self-actualization.
Yeah, I felt like there was we had a very positive direction. I yep. felt like we were moving. I felt like I was moving in a direction of like, okay, this is what we need to spend. This is what I need to spend my time doing.
Yeah.
This is where I need to make my investment.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was actually looking at, essentially taking a leave of absence from my company mm-hmm. so that I could fully invest my time into this new work.
Right.
Because what we were hearing from the research was so inspiring and so, there was so much that we knew there was action that could be taken mm-hmm. to immediately engage in this work mm-hmm. to where there was so much need in our community that I said, okay, I can just draw a small salary from my business mm-hmm. so that I could survive. I could pay more people at my company for it to run. And then I could just, you know, focus on this for a year.
This sounds great on paper.
Sounds great on paper. I had done all the math. I had done everything to make it work.
Yeah.
And then.
And then.
Yeah. Dun, dun, dun. So 2 weeks into the year, had some really unfortunate things happen with some employees of my company that kind of turned the business upside down. And
you know, I've been watching too much Succession when I want to say, is hostile takeover too much of a term, too extreme of a term?
Succession is a great way to kind of put it. I think that's a good description.
Yeah.
It was a lot of unfortunate situations that occurred. Yeah. Had well over half of my staff leave on the same day, mm-hmm. in sort of a coup situation. Mm. So even before the world started crumbling because of the pandemic, I think China was the only country that was in lockdown, mm-hmm. at that point. And so that was the first thing that happened, and completely out of the blue.
Yeah.
Just 5 o'clock in the morning, boom, 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 boom. And so that was the first thing that happened. And so immediately that morning, I have to then start saving my company, which I had already earlier that week started making plans to take my leave and keep some of these employees with much more enhanced salaries and mm-hmm. job descriptions. So that was sort of the first round of unfortunate situation. And then from there, it turned into 2 months of, or a month and a half of trying to save my company, mm. hiring all new staff, mm. training all new staff, while trying to still maintain this research and put this research out there and stand up new committees to get people to be engaged in this work because the community was so excited.
Yeah.
I didn't want the community to feel like, oh, there was just someone else who just came in and took a bunch of research on us and is now not doing anything with it.
Yeah.
And so I had this very strong sense of responsibility that was kind of over me. That's like, I have to do this. And I have a commitment, mm-hmm. to follow through. And so now I have two things weighing on me, right? So I'm saving a company that I've built from scratch, mm-hmm. from a $2,000 loan from my grandfather,
yeah.
to a multi-million dollar agency, to now I'm trying to save as one person. And I'm hiring staff and I'm trying to train staff and I'm trying to keep my clients happy. And that's all weighing on me. And then we make it through the end of January, make it through February, and then March 3rd, 2020.
Which for those who don't remember was?
An EF3 tornado rips through Nashville. And in the overnight hours, my home and the remnants of and my business were both destroyed overnight. My house took a direct hit. Mm-hmm. I lost my house, and I had literally 2 weeks prior had just moved my business offices into my house.
Wow.
So my business, all of my business paperwork, all of my computers, everything was sucked up in the wind and destroyed on that day. And so that was sort of the second blow of like, oh, okay, now we're going to deal with this.
Right.
On top of
when you talk about sucked up in the wind, you know, I always talk about how much of a sucker I am for metaphor when I think about the state of your mental health at this point. You know,
yeah.
I'm like, that's
That's a lot.
The metaphor of the tornado sucking everything up in the wind. It's like it didn't only take the physical.
Yeah.
The metaphor there of not only the physical, but the emotional and the mental health of all of it getting sucked up in the wind.
Yeah.
So where did you go from there?
Well, immediately that night, I drove my totaled vehicle down the highway to a friend's house. So that was an experience. Mm-hmm. But from there, I went into a kind of a state of shock, I think is the best way to put it. Mm-hmm. But also in a state of crisis. Like I knew that I still had things to do, right? I still had clients I had to deliver for. Right. I still had a business to operate. I had a house to somewhat save. And at the same time, I'm also the president of my neighborhood association. So my entire neighborhood is also dealing with this loss.
Right.
And so I step up to the plate and I organize community cleanups and I'm running that. And so I'm trying to help community members who have lost everything. Mm-hmm. And so it was a lot weighing on me at that time. So I'm just kind of operating in this sort of like steam is just kind of operating me. And the necessity of helping people and serving my community and addressing the needs that are there. Right. And so, at that point I'm kind of just moving through the motions.
When everything around you is in crisis, I think it's only human nature that we go into what's the biggest fire. We got to put out the biggest fire and keep going. So you're not able to sit and process any of what.
Yeah, I didn't sit and process for a while.
Yeah.
And then March 15th is when we started shutting down because of COVID. Mm-hmm. And that was the day that I had literally in a matter of 6 hours, I lost 90% of my clients for my company. Mm. I had clients call and every single one of them terminated contracts in 6 hours. So not only did I go from losing my house and my home and my business 2 weeks prior, but then I went and I lost my livelihood and everything that I had built over 10 years, 12 years at that point, gone in a matter of minutes, hours. And so that was an experience that kind of took the wind out of me.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I would say that my clients were at that point, my clients were very, you know, appreciative. They were understanding. They did not operate in this, like, we hate you moment. It was it was nothing ill will about it. They just were like, we have no idea what's happening.
Yeah.
This could be something that's 2 weeks. It could be something that's a year. And sure enough, it was, you know, and still is to, you know, we're still battling it today.
Yep.
And so, you know, the contracts were terminated and they gave me ample notice and did what they had to do, but it put me in a really hard place. Thankfully we had things that the government put in place to sort of help tide businesses over for a while. And that allowed me to continue to run the company for a while and try to figure out what we were going to do. So then those things happened. And then in June, my home was broken into on my birthday, twice back to back.
Wow.
So all of the remaining things that were left in the home that was still half standing following the tornado, were all ripped and stolen out of the house. And then by that point, I think I'm finally at the space of like, okay, basta. I can't put up with anymore.
Yep.
And so I took the time to kind of just escape town for a while and thinking that, okay, what you're going to do is you're going to run away. you're going to just leave town and maybe you won't come back, and maybe you won't come back permanently. Mm. I remember the day that I left town, my partner and I, we were staying in an Airbnb, and I will never forget this day, but I had packed up my car and I had put my dog in the car and I forgot one thing in the house, and he stopped me on the way out the door and he said, and it still kind of like makes me sad and ill when I say this, but he stopped me and he grabbed me on both shoulders and he said, "Am I going to see you again? Am I going to see you again?" Because he was so worried about me. Mm. Because my mental health was so wrecked. I was in such a bad state. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Will I see you again?" He was so scared that I would just go and vanish that day or that week or that trip. Because I had no plans on, I had no idea where I was going. I had no idea when I was coming back. He just said, "Will I see you again?" And I said, "Yes, you will see me again, but I don't know when." Mm. And so he said, and he, at that point, he made the commitment. He said, "I will call you every single day while you're on this trip, but please come home. But please come home." And so I was on the road for 2.5 months.
Wow.
And I couldn't tell you half the places I went because mm-hmm. I don't remember. Because mm-hmm. my mental health was in such disarray.
Yeah.
But I just continued to drive. And I know I went to Virginia and to Washington, D.C. I saw my parents for the first time in like 3 years. Like for an extended period mm-hmm. of time. I went to North Carolina and I went to some other place. I don't really remember all the places I went, to be honest with you. But what I do remember is that the last stop on my trip was outside of Asheville, North Carolina. And I had brought my service animal with me. I had, her name was Charlie. She was my, service animal for 9 years. I rescued her. Still to this day holds the most special place in my heart. We were staying in this like Hampton Inn. Mm-hmm. I don't, not even a place that you would normally catch me in, but, she wouldn't get up out of bed. And, I went to check in on her and noticed that there was a rather large lump in her chest. And so decided to come home that day. And we drove home, brought her to the vet the next morning, and it was an advanced stage of cancer. Mm. And so they were like, "We need to operate rather soon. Let's, you know," and so they did an exploratory surgery. And so at that point, this is like late October, and they say, I will never forget this. I'm home late October. I'm still not healed because I just escaped. Yeah. Right? I didn't really do anything to address my mental health. I just kind of ran away. And
when we don't have healthy coping mechanisms, we do whatever we can to,
or what feels good at the moment. Right. Yep. And, I'm standing in Hillsborough Village here in Nashville. And a doctor calls me and says, the vet calls me and says, "There's nothing we can do. This cancer has advanced too much. Would you like for us to say goodbye?" Mm. And I'm already someone who's been going through so much trauma as it is.
Right.
And I break.
Yeah.
At that point.
Who wouldn't?
Break. And I flip out on the doctor. And I said, "You will stitch my dog back up and you will never call me again." And I probably used many, many other choice words. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a month and a half later, my sweet Charlie passes on.
Yeah.
But it was a day after Christmas. And that was the day that I had my, what I lovingly refer to as my mentee bee.
Mm-hmm.
It was the day that I fully say that I fully collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
My brain and my body just said, you cannot do this anymore on your own. And I said, okay, I'm out. And I said, I said to my partner, I need help. I can't do this anymore. I couldn't get up off the sofa. My body wouldn't want to work. I was crying nonstop. And I was still very much at that point in a suicidal ideation.
Right.
Not to the actual point of actively self-harm,
right,
but very much in the space of
suicidality. Doesn't mean that you have a means and a plan,
right,
at the same time, all the time. It can, right, mean that you no longer have the will to live and,
right,
and in pure ambivalence. And so what did asking for help look like for you?
Asking for help for me was just, it was, I just knew that I needed something more,
yeah,
than what I could offer myself.
Mm-hmm.
Something more than what previously asking for help could have looked like, would,
sure,
have been, you know, calling a therapist or, you know, calling my doctor. And so my partner is in healthcare and he was like, I'm going to take you to a hospital. And sure enough, that's what happened. And within a matter of days, I was in an outpatient program and learned so much about myself,
mm-hmm,
and so much about the process of healing.
Yeah.
And at the same time, also had so many realizations about my past.
Mm-hmm.
Things came into focus for me that I had never had focus on in my entire life.
You finally got to start doing that work.
Correct.
Of placing all of those things we were talking about previously,
right,
in the correct compartment that they belonged in.
And also came to the realization that things happened in my life that I never, ever, ever, ever were able to talk about.
Mm.
Sexual assault. At 40 years old, 39 years old, 38 years old at that point, right?
Yeah.
No, it's all a number at this point, right?
Right.
But
you were that old when you came to this realization, and you're talking about this happened at what age? Ages, because I know it,
yeah,
was repeated.
13.
Yeah. Wow.
Or younger.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I came to that realization in 2021. It's remarkable.
It is.
The greatest description that I've heard of this lived experience for me is that when I came, when you're driving down the road of life,
mm-hmm,
right? We always have rough patches in our life, right? And when we hit a rough patch or we get something, you know, some crap thrown at us,
mm-hmm,
and we don't want to deal with that kind of crap, we just take the junk and we just throw it to the back of the bus.
Yeah.
And we're just driving down, la 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 la, life is great.
Yep.
Life is grand.
Yep.
Okay, junk, great. We'll deal with it, maybe we'll crumple it up or we'll look at it and we'll just say, okay, junk, we'll throw it to the back of the bus. But the reality is that when we hit that traumatic point in our life, like I did in 2020,
mm-hmm,
when we say basta, I can't put up with anymore, or we come to that point of saying life is just too hard,
mm-hmm,
and our bus ends up hitting that wall,
mm-hmm,
or we get into the point of, like, you know, that we've driven the bus into the pool, and
right,
you know, and all of our stuff, all of our junk, all of our crap has come flying forward.
Yep.
You are now stuck not only against that wall or in the pool behind the steering wheel, but all the junk has come flying forward mm-hmm. as well. And the problem is that in order for you to assess the damage around the bus, you still have to dig out of all the junk that's in front of the steering wheel and around mm-hmm. the door beforehand. So once you land into that pool or you've hit the bus against the wall, you have to realize that all of your junk has come flying forward, mm-hmm. right? And so you can't get out of the bus to assess any of the damage. You kind of have to dig out from all of the junk first.
Yeah.
And so you have time that you have to spend time going through all of the junk. You have to look at all the paper. You have to file it all away. You have to put it up on the racks around the bus.
Acknowledge that it's there.
Acknowledge that it's there. Because each of those little things could be traumatic. They could be hurts. They could be pains that you just haven't appropriately dealt with.
Yeah.
And the reality is that when we have all of those things that we haven't appropriately dealt with, those can become increased traumas mm-hmm. and pains that mm-hmm. have affected our responses in life.
Yep.
And so I had to spend so much time going through all of that junk because I never appropriately dealt with all of the pain and hurt and sorrow of the early parts of my life. And then on top of that, I'm dealing with all of what I got dealt with in 2020.
Right.
So it was a year and a half of just dealing with
past and present trauma. Yeah.
And being able to figure out how I can appropriately navigate that. Mm. And also realizing that our bodily pains, mm-hmm. our back pain, mm-hmm. our stomach pain, our headaches, what have you, all of joint pain, whatever it might be, are all directionally related back to
trauma
what's going up here.
Oh, absolutely.
As well.
You know, Bessel van der Kolk talks about the body keeps the score.
Right.
Absolutely.
When, right.
You know, directly related to
right.
trauma, neurological. Yeah. All it's all connected.
Every bit of it.
So I want to ask you here, what if you had to name one or, the top most significant things that helped you heal, mm-hmm. could you share a little bit of that?
Writing. I have used writing as a brain dump to get every single thing out. It's been helpful to just be able to let go, to get the thoughts that continually narrate sometimes the very existence of life
yep.
out onto paper. And honestly, buying a journal that you love to write in and buy many of them.
Yeah.
Find the one piece of paper and the special pen that you like to write with to have consistency.
Yeah.
Because sometimes inconsistency will make you not want to go back and continue to go back to the same thing.
Interesting.
I have found that to work for myself. Like there's a journal that I love from Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And a pen that I love from a particular seller. And sure. I consistently use the same ones.
I love that piece of advice.
Right?
That's great.
I see a therapist every single week. Every single week.
Amen to that.
And there's been multiple times I'm like, you sure you want to continue seeing a therapist every week? I'm like, yes. Don't question me.
Yep.
Every single week.
Yep.
And then I've added a psychiatrist on once a month.
Heck yeah.
Because that helps as well. Those are important pieces to the mm-hmm. to my balancing all of the reality of what life is.
Well, one of the themes that I hear you saying is not only those three things, but consistency with those three things.
Yeah.
And you mentioned balance. Mm-hmm. And I could not echo for myself the mm-hmm. the need and the importance of that more. I also just wanted to mention that, you know, when I ask that question about what has helped you most heal to people that I interview, journaling is usually number one or number two for all of them.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's powerful. And I think there's science behind it. I don't know what it is, but I think there's scientific proof behind the neurology of like how it, you know, the synapses fire in a different way. Mm-hmm. You know, we reprocess things. And like you said, there's just something about putting things out there rather than just thinking the thoughts.
Yep.
So helpful.
Other things I'll tell you too is I am consistent. I try to be as consistent as I can with my self-care. So it's, you know, chiropractic visits, massage, it's little things like even, you know, making sure that my manicures are scheduled and little things like that, right? Because doing the little things that make you feel good, make sure that allow you to feel valued.
Yeah.
Right. I think those are important pieces to the lived experience, to our lived experiences. I also make sure that I am getting 8 hours of sleep.
Ooh, amen to that.
Right?
Yes.
And that means that if I am tired, I'm going to take a nap.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no shame in that.
Yeah.
So.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
So I love that we've made it through, to this place of healing for you and, you know, to present day where we talk about, again, you know, how we kind of started off, you know, you and I see each other and it's like, how you doing? Oh, it's a day, but you know what? I've got the gratitude that we have the tools and the good people and the friends that check in and I can be honest with you. We can be honest with each other about where I am today.
Yeah.
That's such a powerful, powerful place to be. Yeah. Because it's not in bondage anymore.
Yep.
So I want to end with talking about Inclusion Tennessee.
Sure.
So Inclusion Tennessee is the result of all that work that you started, you know, with the help of some other people in the community and came together. What is the main, right now, what is the main mission, goal, focus of Inclusion Tennessee? Where's the status of the progress and where do you want to go?
So our mission at Inclusion Tennessee is to connect people to programs, services, and resources that enhance the multifaceted and beautiful LGBTQI plus community that exists throughout Tennessee. And when we think about connecting community, when we think about connecting people to programs and services, that can mean anything, right? That can mean connecting people into healthcare. It can mean connecting people into an AA meeting or into a sober practice or connecting someone into a Western medicine practice or a traditional medicine practice, or connecting our nonprofit organizations together to create a better program, right? And so there's so many needs that exist in our community. And so our goal is to really think about how we can be thoughtful and connective, to act sort of as that connective tissue that is so desperately needed to enhance our community for the better, right? To be that service that connects people year round when there are great needs. And so we have three programs that we're focused on. We're basing all of that on that 2019 research.
Yep.
You know, when I walked out of my outpatient program back in 2021, the first thing I did was write. And it was not writing for my own mental health. It was actually writing a business plan for that, for this organization. And we took all that research and we said, okay, 2,500 people have said that they want a strong connection. They want to see our nonprofits be connected to one another.
Yep.
So we've created a program called Embrace. And Embrace is really focused around getting our nonprofits to have all be at the same table. So we believe that every single person has a seat at the table. Every single organization deserves a seat at the table. No one is underneath the table. No one has to stand in the room. Everyone has equity at this table.
Yeah.
And we are all working together for the common good of our community.
Yeah.
Because all of this work is intersectional,
right? I'm going to just say it too, so you don't have to, but to hopefully remove some of the felt competition between what people might perceive are competing nonprofits. And
well, I'll tell you that. I mean, nonprofits are messy. Right? The work of nonprofits are it's messy work. It is hard work. And it's often thankless work. And I think the reality of it is that nonprofits have often built themselves as these, as silos, right? And so one of our core missions or goals is that we are going to essentially try to build bridges between these silos. We don't want to tear the silos down because that's also tearing down how nonprofits work.
Right.
We have to realize that the culture of nonprofits are not going to necessarily change because another nonprofit's in the space. Right.
But they
can find ways to connect. Right. And we can find ways to work together. And so that's one of our goals with this Embrace program. The second program that we've created is one called Flourish. And that's really focused on this idea that all LGBTQI plus people deserve equal access to care. And so care looks at a number of different things, right? Care can be Western and traditional medical practices, but it also could mean social care. It can mean spiritual care. It could mean having access to what have you, right? And anything that revolves around this idea that you can live a full, happy, healthy life. And so we want to make sure that people can be connected into any aspect of care that they need so that they are fully seen as human, that they deserve, and they can deserve every access to care that is needed. And then finally, our last program is, our last program for now, I should say, is called Gather. And we are committed to creating safe spaces for people throughout Tennessee. You have talked earlier about the gay bar and how the gay bar is so important, has been so important to our culture. But we also understand that gay bars are not for everyone. And they're certainly not for our whole community.
That wouldn't have been an option for me in my first year or so of sobriety as a recovering person.
And safe space is not always available at nightlife. And so we want to think about what does safe space look like from a, in a physical community center type space. What is needed in community centers? In a community center, and what does that look like? And so we are actively looking at how we can build a community center here in Middle Tennessee, and then also create pop-up safe spaces around the state.
I get excited about all three of these things, but that last one just gets me so jazzed. I can't wait to reverberate and celebrate and you know, all these things as they move forward. Inclusion Tennessee has so much, when I say so much further to go, it's not a picture of where it hasn't gone yet. It's that the world is just unfolding before us. And you know, we just saw this beautiful concert that was just had. To support Inclusion Tennessee and some other wonderful organizations in our state that are that have great
also
causes,
doing incredible work.
And so I, you know, I wish you the best. I'm so glad to be a small part supporting you all, and yeah, it's really wonderful. I want to thank you for being so bringing your vulnerability here today. And every day, but just on our platform, it's special, it's meaningful. I know that it has changed, is changing, and will continue to change other people's lives for the better. And I always like to wrap up by asking for that person listening or watching that has identified with any part of your story and says, you know, I'm struggling. What last piece of encouragement would you like to leave for them?
That you belong, that you belong to something beautiful, and that you are loved fully and wholly for who you are. Yeah.
Perfect. Perfectly put. And I'll end by saying what I always do. I mean it just as much as I always say this. I'm going to say, it's never too late to start loving yourself. And you're only ever one decision away from a completely different life.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.